on an absolute scale, if the music you write and perform has intrinsic value in it, in the music or the lyrics or why you do it, then I think you can't really be unhappy. Because even if you're just playing it for yourself, you still have something intrinsic that you're contributing to.
You're listening to the Write Room Podcast with me, Rupen Paul. I'm a stand-up comedian from India, and this is my weekly podcast. A show where I have conversations with people whom I consider accomplished, entertaining, and inspiring. Hey, hello, and welcome to the Write Room Podcast. My name is Rupen Paul, and with me is a very special guest, and someone I'm so stoked to have on this podcast, Mr. KP Krishnamurthy, ex-Mindsnare, Fractaline. I don't know if I should say ex-Fractaline or Fractaline, musician, one of the pioneers of the metal scene in India, now residing in the US, and I'm so happy that you're doing this. Thank you so much, KP, for doing this.
Sure, glad to be here, man.
This is pretty cool because, like, I was just checking out your stuff. Like, I think I tuned into Mindsnare about 10 or 11 years ago, probably, right? In 2009, I guess, right? And this was so cool because this was, like, I think very rarely, I think this is there in across fields in the arts. Like if you're in comedy, it's like a comedian's comedian, right? But you guys were like the musician's musician in India. You guys were the first of the kind to do that, right? And because the thing is, you guys were playing music and making music that was very, very appealing to musicians because in terms of its technicality. So was that something that you guys thought of while forming a band? Like, we're going to, you know, cater to a very niche community of musicians, and or was there something that just happened throughout the course as you started Mindsnare?
Well, firstly, thank you for saying that. That I think that's a really awesome compliment. Well, it didn't exactly start out like we were trying to play music for musicians or anything of that sort. Because honestly, I personally know tons of musicians way better than any of us in the band. And it would be kind of presumptuous to kind of say that. But that said, it was definitely something we were trying to do to kind of write music that wasn't pedestrian, wasn't normal. And the reasons for writing music for us was, at least we like to think that it was something a little deeper than just, you know, being brutal or being heavy or getting famous. So, you know, some of the usual motivations that drive some people. But that is something that most metal bands are like that. I mean, I don't really think anyone forms a metal band in order to get famous, because if you do that, you're gonna fail pretty miserably.
Especially with metal, that's not the place where there's the money. It's not the place,
or the fame,
which with all the women. Or it's the place.
No. Yeah. If you never want to get laid, just form a metal band.
Play metal.
Play some Cannibal Corpse covers. You're good.
Yeah, I think I also think that I don't know if you'd agree, but metal is a very nerdy genre of music, right?
Oh, yes.
Because it's a very, very, yeah, like, you either, it's for the type of people who really like to get into a rabbit hole of one thing and just go deep into it.
Completely. Yes. I think most metalheads are nerds every sense. And a lot of it has to do with kind of metal being an outlet, at least for me. I'm speaking for myself, and there'll be people who experienced similar things growing into metal, and people who got into metal for totally different reasons, obviously. But for me, it was a really nice escape into a reality where the lyrics actually meant something in a lot of cases. It kind of dovetailed into the other stuff I was into. Like, I was heavily into science fiction. I was into electronics was a hobby of mine. So super nerdy stuff. And this kind of played right into that kind of stuff.
Right. I was going to ask you, because I was a huge fan of the lyrics of Mindsnare, right? Aravo, I think, I don't know if you guys had still have the website running. Do you guys still have the website running?
Well, not the website, but I think, you know, there are a bunch of these websites that scrape other sites, and you can go to, like, say, darklyrics.net or something like that, and you'll be able to find our lyrics over there.
Yeah.
But our website right now, I've just redirected mindsnare.com to, I don't remember, either the Facebook page or maybe Bandcamp or something like that.
Right, because for those of you listening, you guys got to check out the lyrics. It's very unique, and I wanted to ask you, I had a specific question for the lyrics, right? Because you use a lot of imagery from science fiction, and it's so interesting that it fits in so perfectly with, like, the structure of the riffs, because the riffs are, like, so well-structured, and there's just certain, there's certain ways in which you write those lyrics, right? Where it fits in, it's just, like, molded around those lyrics. I don't even know if it's molded around the lyrics or the lyrics come first. How is it in Mindsnare? Did the lyrics come first, and did you find, like, a way to...
Most of the time, the lyrics come first. The lyrics kind of set the structure of a song, but I can't really take credit for, like, I'd say it's like 60-40 Yas and me in terms of fitting the lyrics into vocal patterns that fit into the riffs, because Yas, before she started playing the drums, she was a vocalist, and she used to play for this band in Bangalore called Angel Dust back in the day, like in the late 90s and stuff like that, with Chris Avinash, Ryan Glasso, and a few other people who are kind of still in the scene. Like, Ryan used to play drums for Kryptos for quite a while, and she used to sing for that band for a bit. And a lot of the ideas to, like, syncopate the vocals with the riffs were in collaboration with her in the jam room. And we used to practice like crazy. Like, I don't know why we used to jam that much, but it used to be pretty much every day for most of the week. And yeah, so we used to, like, construct all that in the jam room. It wasn't people working separately and putting it together in the jam room. It was, like, it happened there.
Right. So when did this idea of, you know, incorporating, like, all the science fiction and all the science stuff come into minds? When did that happen? And how did that happen also?
Well, that's typically, so I write the lyrics based on my experiences and my interests and various flavors of depression that I'm going through at the moment when I'm writing the lyrics. So that kind of informs the topics I write about. And also some of the songs, like Use the Pain, is literally about needing to be in a particular frame of mind where you're not particularly happy, when you're feeling depressed, when there is emotional pain about something or the other that you are then channeling into
art or
your music, or, you know. Yeah, so it's most of the lyrics are kind of a commentary on some topic, well, whatever the song is about. And a lot of it is introspective. So sci-fi is one of the tools that is useful in that context.
Right. So is this something that you incorporate into music based on that was an interest of yours, and and at the same time you felt that it would be really relevant to convey, like, themes that we are trying to cover through our music, through your music rather?
Well, the themes were kind of picked based on what we viscerally felt strongly about. Like, Use the Pain is about what I just said. And another song on the album is Alter Ego, which is, you know, about how the audience of famous bands, not us, but, you know, like, talking about like seriously famous bands and stuff, kind of expect the band members to behave the way the fans want them to. And as soon as the band members don't do that, the fans kind of lose it for the band. You know, what happened with Metallica and stuff like that. I mean, even I just listened to the first four albums. I don't like much
of the later stuff.
After that, no. But we did have a few conversations about that kind of stuff, and it's kind of inherently unfair that somebody has to base their reality on what people think they should be like. So we thought we'd write a song about that. And that, I think, was Yasmin's idea, lyrical idea. I think I wrote most of the lyrics, but it was based on an idea that she had, and we spoke about it and stuff like that.
Yeah, speaking of which, like, what is your opinion on this entire topic, right? Like, because, like, so far, like, the truth is, like, you know, as a band, or even as a person, or as a musician, you keep evolving, like, your changes keep, your tastes keep changing,
right?
Your preferences, like, what do you like about music keeps changing, right? And at the same time, there's what the audience always likes about you, right? So, like, even if you were in Mindsnare, you'd be like, this is typical Mindsnare. And now this new stuff is not exactly Mindsnare,
yes,
right? So how do you reconcile that difference? Okay, so how do you reconcile that difference, basically?
I don't know. Because, like, Mindsnare, a lot of people like Mindsnare. But then I came to the States and Frackline happened. And a lot of the songs that I wrote for Frackline were not as well liked as the Mindsnare songs by a lot of people who I was, you know, it kind of surprised me. And I don't really know that I understand the difference, but that's also because it's too close to me. It's too in my face, because I wrote both the music for Mindsnare as well as Frackline. So it's kind of hard to analyze it from an outsider's perspective. And to me, it's kind of like, you know, I have to write the music that's coming out. I cannot try and cater to something, because the minute I start doing that, I'm trying to kind of, in effect, write cover songs that sound like what our older songs used to sound like. So,
you're covering your older version of yourself, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if I was getting paid like $200 an hour to do that, I might do that. But I don't. We end up paying to release albums and stuff and book shows and tour and stuff like that. So, I mean, why?
Yeah, do you think that becomes a problem for certain bands? Because, like, there's obviously, like, a few people in the band, especially the people who write songs, right? Especially people who write the riffs and the music, right? And they want to take the band to a newer sound, because that's what's going to keep them excited, at least. And also keep the music exciting. But at the same time, there's a portion of the band, like, for example, Metallica. It's a great example you brought up, right? I think especially with Some Kind of Monster, it was like a completely different band. Right,
and I haven't even heard that album. It's
completely different. Like, it was the most hated album. I don't even think they play any of their songs live anymore. Right, and the recent albums, right, they've kind of gone back to the older sound, right? And so, which I'm guessing is it's a conscious, deliberate decision which they made. Like, I think we got to go back to the older stuff. So, do you think that's a point of contention that happens sometimes between bands? Like, there are a few people who want to go a different way, and there are a few people who say, let's remain.
I'm sure it does. I can't speak to, obviously, Metallica, because I've never met them and I'm never going to meet them. But in Frackline itself, that kind of happened, because Jordan, the vocalist, he wanted to put in clean vocals, and I was not okay with that, because I don't see clean vocals working with any of the music that I'm writing on the guitar. And we had, we didn't have arguments about it, because it was kind of like, he was fine with me kind of directing the direction. But if we weren't going to have that understanding, I can see it causing a lot of problems. And, you know, bands break up all the time because of musical differences. That's not something that is unheard of. People grow. People write music that they were proud of 10 years ago, and right now they are a different person. And the kind of music they want to make changes. And, you know, in 10 years, you've had so many life experiences that shapes who you are. I have a kid now, and a lot of things about that whole process is so life-changing that I can't really imagine being passionate about some of the topics that I was passionate about 10 years ago. Because the depth that I felt was there, right now I don't feel that depth anymore because I've changed as a person. So when that happens to music, the music you write is also going to change. And if that changes and the audience wants you to stick to what you were back then, it's going to be a clash between who you are and what other people want you to be.
Got you. You brought up a point which I wanted to pick your brains about. You're saying, like, you know, in a band, there's one person who's directing the entire music, right? And it's a very interesting point because I think every band has that one person. Like every famous band in the world has like that one. I think in Iron Maiden, it's more or less like Steve Harris and like, I think probably
Steve Harris does everything. Yeah.
Steve Harris does everything. And pretty cool that, like, I think Iron Maiden is, it gets way less a credit than it should get in terms of a bass player handling the entire operation.
Yeah. Right? Well, I think the bass player in metal thing is something that needn't be the way it is, because I think the stereotype of a bass player in heavy metal not doing as much as the rest of the band has unfortunately come about because of some bands using the bass in that kind of way. But there are so many people. I mean, there's DiGiorgio, who plays some crazy stuff on the Death albums, like if you listen to Individual Thought Patterns or something like that. Human, I believe. So it depends. I'm personally not very surprised that Steve Harris is able to be the genesis of a lot of their music, but it's definitely not a common thing. To your point about one person driving the writing, I don't know that that's always the case. In some cases, in some bands, it's true. But, I mean, I just don't know enough about enough bands and how they work internally to actually say too much more than that. But, I'm not sure that's always the case.
Oh, right. Okay. Because, like, what I've observed is this is another thing which I've observed about, like, bands. I think most of the songwriting and much of the sound happens with two people, right? Like, I think in your case, it's with you and Yasmin, if I'm not wrong, right? In many other cases, right, like it's just two people, it's just like a team of two people who get what the basis of the band's sound is, right?
Yes.
But even in that two musician partnership, right, there's one person who's like the leader of the band, and everyone says, like, okay, I think the best bet is to just follow that person, right? And so do you think, like, a success for a band is for everyone else in the band is to just be on agreement and be like, yeah, I think we should just follow what he has in store, because it's like he sees a complete thing or she sees a complete thing.
To a large extent, yes. I think if in Mindsnare, if either Yas or me had been more of a leader than the other, we would have probably lasted longer as well. But the problem was both of us were leaders at the same time. And beyond a point, that gets a little hard because ideas start butting up against each other and it gets a little difficult to have one single direction to pull the band in, because, you know, there'll be disagreements. But if there is the ability of one person to lead and kind of have veto power while taking inputs from the rest of the band, I think it will probably end up being a smoother
operation. Right, I got you. Here's one thing that I wanted to ask you. I think I have a few more questions about the music, but I was actually going to talk about, like, the other non-music stuff before, but it's great that we're having this conversation now, so we can get this out of the... I mean, like, only the true musician fans are going to listen to the second part of the conversation. the question is, like, you handled all the riffs and you handled all the vocals, right?
Right.
And wasn't that, like, a great juggle that you had to do? Because these are not like, these are not like riffs that you're just playing like a bunch of bar chords, right? You were playing pretty complicated riffs. So how did you train yourself to do that as a musician while playing like just riffs and singing and, you know, doing all the other part of like leading the entire song?
Well, I practiced getting these latch points in the riffs where I would start and stop the vocals and stuff like that. And while playing, it's more like the vocals and the guitars feel like one instrument. It doesn't feel like you're doing two separate things, because I don't know that it's possible to do two separate things simultaneously, but it's more like, you know, you're using your hands to play the guitar and make the riffs come out. And another part of the same overall instrument is your vocals. And you got to fit the vocals in to portions of the riffs where, like, you know, there are things to think about. Like, do you need to look at the fretboard to play that particular portion of the yeah. riff? If you do, then it could be kind of a problem, because a lot of those riffs, I wasn't 100% able to pull it off live without looking at the fretboard, at least in the beginning when the songs were new and stuff, because I'm a reasonably average guitarist. I can handle things that I practice a lot reasonably well, but it needs a lot of practice. So if I've written a new song and the vocals go in with the riffs, I need to make sure that I've got some leeway and kind of make it a little easier for myself. And one of the worst challenges for me was changing guitar patches in the middle, because when you're singing, you gotta like fucking yeah. feel the buttons on the damn processor to yeah. figure out which one to press. And yeah, so stupid things like that become really complicated issues sometimes when you're performing live. And right. We couldn't, you know, we didn't have someone backstage
pressing
the buttons.
You didn't have a guitar tech pressing all the knobs for you.
No. So yeah, those I think were some of the more challenging aspects of it, rather than just the guitar and vocals, because guitar and vocals, you can practice it, you can do it, but the rest of it, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think there's also the reason why metalheads don't get laid, because there's so much of shit that you have to handle on stage. You can't notice yeah. someone over there on the side.
Right.
Right. I think I want to like pick your brains about a bunch of things, right? Because when did you guys start?
Yeah.
When did Mindsnare start?
Mindsnare started, the name Mindsnare was attached to a musical project back in around 2000, when I released this really terrible recording of three songs. Three or maybe four, I've even forgotten. That was in the year 2000. It had a few originals and a weird cover of Iron Maiden's 22 Acacia Avenue made into
which by the way, guys, if you're listening to this, it's basically a song about visiting a red light district and like sympathizing with a prostitute, right? It's like, why are you going this way in life?
Yeah, right. Basically
very very right. unique choice of cover.
It's an awesome song. And
it's an
yeah,
awesome
I mean, I don't recommend anybody listens to that thing that I put out. It's called Mindsnare 1, and I think somebody pirated it onto YouTube at some point. It's terrible. But I actually burnt CDs and sold them or gave them away or something at the first Death Fest that took place in Bombay in 2000. And I remember that Threnody played that Demon Stealer, Arcane Ritual, and a few others. It's pretty cool.
Right. So what was life like before Mindsnare? What happened? Like, what was life like completely before you started playing? And was Mindsnare 1 you guys as a band, or was it like a demo that you put
together?
No, that
was. Yeah, let me complete that then. That was a demo that I put together, and I wanted to find a band. I'll tell you in just a bit about a couple of other bands I had been a part of before that. But that was mm-hmm. me putting together some music so that I could take it out to people and say, hey, do you want to play on this and stuff like that. And that was prior to anybody else joining. I program the drums using a digital audio workstation, recorded my own vocals and guitar and all that. Terrible quality. I didn't have the budget for an actual proper sound card and stuff like that in those days. And recorded that. After that is when Yasmin joined the band, and a couple others. We went through a few members playing bass, and finally Narayan became the first like long-term member, after which when Narayan was replaced by Sandesh, that's around when we recorded the album.
Right. So, and so what was happening in your life before?
Yeah, before. Well, there were a couple bands that I'd been a part of before that. I was part of this band called Abaddon. We found the name because we just like went through a list of like demon gods or some shit like that, and we thought it was really cool. And
I can write. I should one day in my life write like an entire comedy sketch on how metal bands choose their names, especially metal
seriously.
Bands. Seriously, hilarious. Yes.
we've done all of that stuff. So anyway, yeah. So that band was a good amount of fun, actually. Wrote a few songs. JP was in that band. Jayaprakash Satyamurthy, if you know, he's still in the scene.
I do not.
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, so he was in the band, a couple of other guys. And when that band split up, a little while after that, I joined Threnody and played not that long. I don't even think it was a full year or something, but we played some shows. It was a lot of fun. We had a great time with Siddharth and Satish on the drums. Siddharth's still in Threnody. They're still going on. And so those were the two actual bands that I was a part of before the Mindsnare One thing, and then Mindsnare started. Yep.
Right, so at what point did you know that metal is your thing? And also, after knowing metal, were you like always like a very niche metalhead, like in digging all the stuff that was underground? Or did you start off like mainstream and then like work your way through all the underground stuff?
I definitely started mainstream. And the day I realized that metal was for me was in 7th standard, when my cousin gave me a tape with Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast and Somewhere in Time on side A and side B. I heard that, and I had not heard anything even remotely similar to that in the past. And right. It was fucking awesome. I still remember walking up the stairs in 7th standard, going to my class and like thinking, holy shit, I found what I wanted. And I just like got all the Iron Maiden tapes, then started on Judas Priest, then started on, you know, all the old school heavy metal stuff like Maiden, Priest, Sabbath, Dio, Motorhead, stuff like that. And the rest of the real heavy stuff was much later. A few years later, I started getting into that. Initially, I couldn't really stand the kind of vocals that I do in Mindsnare. I thought it was like ridiculously terrible.
Right.
But it grew on me, and you know, that kind of became what I wanted to do as well.
All right. And did you have like a musical background coming out of, or is this something that you found and developed like with you in seclusion as being like a metalhead nerd?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there were other metalhead nerds that I was associating with at that point, and it was all of us doing that thing. But music, there's no one really, no musical stuff in my family, for instance. It didn't start like that. It was basically the people I was hanging out with, which ended up basically being the Bangalore scene. You know, because all of us hung out with each other, and
So was that like a really big metal band before you guys?
Millennium. Millennium is...
haven't heard of it at all. It's so interesting.
You've not heard of Millennium? What the hell, dude? You probably heard of Roberto Narayan. Drummer?
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, you Google his name.
right,
you'll see a lot of stuff. And mm-hmm. check out Millennium. They are actually pretty cool. And
I'm going to get into so much of flack, by the way, with all your mind snap and cult mind snap. I was like, who the fuck is this guy who doesn't know anyone but knows mind snap? Yeah. All right. Okay. So they were the band that was there before you.
Yeah, check out. I didn't really know them personally, but I had gone to see some of their shows kind of early on when I was like 16 or 17 or something, when you could still drink when you were 16 in Bangalore and stuff. That, you know, not that I drank much when it was legal to do so, but back then it was a cool thing to do. But yeah, I still remember seeing them playing at UVCE College in Bangalore, and
right.
that was a really good show. I went there with one of my really old friends, and I think they played with Parikrama at some show on in Palace grounds as well at some point. I went to that as well. Don't remember seeing them too many times, but They were pretty cool. They had, I think they were the first Indian metal band to have a video on MTV getting aired and stuff. So that was pretty cool. Yeah.
So, and at what point did you know that, like, there's something, because you played with a bunch of bands, right? And that you knew that you had something very unique with Mindsnare? Or was it something else where you thought, like, I have this music that I want to play, which I'm not able to fit in any other band, so let me start something of my own and try to find a way to make this happen?
Yeah, that's it. That's right. Exactly right. Because I had a lot of fun with Trinity, but there were things I wanted to do that Siddharth didn't want to do. And he had valid reasons for not wanting to, because he had a very defined vision for what he wanted Trinity's sound to be like. And I respected that, but there were things I wanted to experiment with, and that's what led to starting the whole Mindsnare thing off.
Right. And so what is like the first big break that happened? Because do you remember your early crowd sizes?
The thing is, a lot of the shows in India happen at colleges, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially for bands that are starting out and stuff.
Yeah.
So the crowd is kind of built in because it's a college fest. So when you're playing over there, you do have some people over there because either they've got nothing else to do or they are actually interested in watching some Western music bands perform. And I think it was all these competitions that basically allowed us to refine how we played on stage, understanding how you need to do things so you sound good on stage and stuff. It took a while because money was scarce and getting good equipment wasn't really easy. And those days you couldn't even really
there were no pro shops. There was no.
No.
Do you remember how you did? I mean, at that time, how did most people and you get your gear?
Reynolds was the store that a lot of us used to go to Residency Road or something.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting Bangalore roads. I've been out of India for the last 10 years. I remember that I got my Zoom guitar processors from there. Terrible processors, sound like ass, but that's pretty much the only thing you could get. I couldn't afford a proper guitar, so I went to Chennai to this guy called Tulsi Musicals, who made guitars, custom-made guitars based on whatever designs you gave him. And the preliminary quest, you know about that, the 3-song EP that we released prior to the album?
Yep.
That, I think, was recorded on that guitar. So that was not a brand-name guitar. It was all cheap as
shit. It was all assembled and
Yeah. And it was okay, but, you know, like, some people think that it's cool to play with substandard equipment and still try and make it sound good and stuff. But,
that's like the entire philosophy of Nirvana, I think. Right?
Yeah, but I don't know that I agree with that. You know, like in those days, if someone had gifted me a really good Ibanez or Jackson or Schecter or something like that, I would have totally taken it and it would have sounded better.
Right. And I'm guessing it was so hard at that time, right, in the early 2000s, because the only place that you could perform were at like college festivals, and there were no clubs, there were no metal clubs, right? There was probably, was B flat around? Was B flat around when you were just started?
No, B flat wasn't around. There were a couple others.
Right. Was it like difficult pitching music? Because first of all, like the idea of playing live music is, and especially music that's in English and all of that, it's very difficult.
It's cabaret, right? It's cabaret, naked women all over the place, right?
That's it's I think the equivalent, I was going to say, it's like almost like doing porn, right? Like you, like you tell your, even like the fact that you have to explain to like everyone around you, right? Like your parents ask, like, what do you do? I'm a musician. That's like how I'm actually an actor. And like, can you come for one of your shows? No way. There's no way I'm going to come for one of this. Right. But I'm guessing it would be really difficult pitching your music to that audience.
Well,
at that time,
I don't think that we had that much trouble because we didn't go out pitching our music to an audience that much. We just played because we wanted to play it. And we played at college fests, and there were people who liked it. There were people who didn't. There were people who made fun of us. And there were people who took their shirts off and danced tapanguchi because they couldn't figure out how to react to this kind of crazy screams coming out of there. Yeah. And all that is perfectly valid. If you're enjoying it, you're enjoying it, you know. It's something you've not heard before. So it's not really cool to look down on people who haven't heard a certain style of music. And, you know, so... I don't think we tried to really pitch it. And honestly, if we had, we would have probably had more success playing more gigs. But I'm not very good at networking and meeting people and organizing shows and stuff. I hate doing that shit. So I was really bad at it. And Yas was a little better at it. But neither of us were, you know, the kind of... entertainment business kind of person you need to be in order to actually
network and push through with, so you guys were around in how long 10 years, is it safe to say, a little more than 10 years in India?
About 10 years,
which is a fairly long time for a metal band to come through, right? Because you guys have been there for 10 years, and it's pretty difficult because like everyone has their own way in which they want to take the music, and for you guys to stick to 10 years is pretty cool. And at this point, I think you guys made the move from India to go and study at MI, right?
Yeah, in 2009.
So how did that happen?
It was like we played a lot of the kind of shows that you could get to play in India, and we'd kind of reached a point where, okay, now what? We knew that we are never going to make money out of the music in India. We are never going to do more than what we were already doing, which is playing an okay number of shows every year and maybe releasing more music. But it was kind of like, okay, do we try and take this to some next level that is theoretically potentially possible, or do we, are we happy with this? And also it's kind of like... You know, it's always good to explore outside of where you're born. I mean, I was born in Bangalore. I didn't live in any other city until I was 30 years old when I left. And there is a certain amount of like, okay, so if we go there, we can try new things. We can potentially meet other people who are into the same kind of music, see what happens. And some of that did work out. Some of that did not. Like Fractaline, I'm glad that I came here because, you know, there are 15 songs that managed to get written and published that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And with Fractaline, I managed to, like, we did a pretty good tour of the Western US, and we played like five or something gigs in India as well. So I'm glad that all that stuff happened. And if we hadn't moved, a lot of that couldn't have.
Right, so this was a very conscious choice that you guys moving to MI to study music. This was basically the next step ahead from what you say, right? So, but it would have been a little bit I would not say weird, but it would have been a different experience, right? Because you had joined like music school after about after playing about like say maybe more than 10 years music like professionally. So
so that it doesn't matter how long you've been playing. I mean, the there are so many bad habits that you build up if you aren't taught a certain way to do things, and like see like 20 other people around you do things in different ways and learn from them. And if you don't have that kind of back and forth, that like I think people who have been playing like 50 years will still stand to gain by going to some sort of a schooling thing if they want to. Some people are going to be like, if your guitar is a tool and you're extracting what you want out of it, then music school is of no value because you're already getting what you want out of the guitar. But if you want to try and see what else is there, what else is possible, and also mainly for us, it was the fact that being in MI would put us in Los Angeles where we'd be able to find other musicians, play other shows, and have a different jumping off point in order to be able to see what we can do with our music and maybe, you know, fan out individually and create different bands and stuff like that as well.
Right. And so how did what was music school like? I've never spoken to anyone like a professional musician has gone to music school, right? And I don't even know too many bands that have studied music like professionally. The only thing I think of is Dream Theater, right? I think they all met at music school. I think they met at Berkeley.
No, they went to real music school. MI is... Yeah, they went to Berkeley. Berkeley's crazy shit, dude. I wouldn't survive in Berkeley. I wouldn't survive over there at all. But MI is different. MI is contemporary music where it's more like... they make it so that you can play the kind of music you want and pick the kind of classes you want to specialize in whatever you are interested in. And you get the information you need to make your playing better. So, for instance, like for metal, there are a couple of classes just catering to metal techniques, tapping, things like that. For bass, there are like slap pop classes, for instance, if you want to, like, you can take that as a credit. You can take one of the really cool things about MI was their live playing workshops, or LPWs we used to call them, where you're given a song and you learn the song and you get put together with a random bunch of guys who've also learned the song, guys and girls, and you perform the song on stage and you get rated based on how you do it. And that is pretty cool because some of the songs we did was like Painkiller was one song, Judas Priest, and Gojira, Toxic Garbage Island was another song. And playing those kinds of songs in a school setting and getting critiqued on it and all that was pretty cool. It's not something I would ever forget easily, but it's a lot of money. It's a shit ton of money, especially when you convert rupees into dollars. It's like you're paying a lot of cash.
Right. So I'm guessing you all had to work a ton of extra jobs to repay like your student loan and all of that.
I mean, you can't work while going to school and be able to repay anything because immigration rules don't let you do that. You need if you're there on a visa to be a student, you aren't allowed to work outside the school. And inside the school, the only jobs you kind of have are like, you know, work in the library, which I did for a bit. But that pays you $800 a month, which kind of, you know, doesn't even pay the rent. So my plan was to, I was into software engineering since when I was like 14 or something like that. And I was already working in India. So my plan was to, like, you know, it was timed well with the recession and all that. So we went to MI, and after that, my plan was to get back into coding and hopefully get a job in one of the music industry companies in LA doing that. And that way I'll be able to mix the music side of things with the tech side of things and stuff and use that to pay it off. And that's what I ended up doing.
Awesome. Awesome. What was it like apart from like music school, right? And how many years of how many years was it at MI?
I was in there for 2 years.
2 years, all right. And was that a particular program that you did, or was this like a bunch of credits that you have to?
Depending on the credits, you get whatever degree that you're aiming for. So I got an associate's degree in guitar performance with also I did a couple quarters of audio engineering. So it's a combined degree. So guitar performance with an emphasis on audio engineering.
Right. And like, what was the main issue in India? Like, were you able to play like music professionally in terms of completely relying on music to pay the bills? Or was this something that you could only do even after 10 years with an added income of a job?
I don't think it is ever going to be possible in any country to play heavy metal music and pay all your bills, and unless you're Iron Maiden or Metallica. It's like, you know, and even Iron Maiden and Metallica didn't know that until they became who they are now. It's not like they planned for that to happen and decided to do that. I mean, they planned what they planned, and it's a good thing that they are where they are at, but that's not going to happen to everyone. So it's not about whether that could happen in India or couldn't happen in India, that's why we moved here or anything of that sort, because we didn't really think that's going to be possible in the States either. Mm-hmm. Because firstly, in the States, LA is kind of the capital of the music and movie
and the entertainment
everywhere.
Industry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The worldwide. And mm-hmm. we weren't egotist enough to think that we would be so much better than the rest of everyone who's already over here and are pros to even get any kind of recognition. And there are like people over here, you'll see some incredibly talented people who work as waiters in order to pay the rent. So
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think that's how it is. But was like the US any different in terms of providing the place for you all to play your music? In being more supportive?
In the US, you can set up tours that go to a lot of small towns where there are metalheads, there are audiences, there are much smaller audiences than we were used to in India, because in India, we played college shows, or after we were reasonably well known, we played, you know, shows like in clubs in Bombay and Bangalore and stuff like that. But Bombay and Bangalore are huge cities, right?
They are.
Like, it's like in the States, you can go play shows where around like 100 people might turn up on a really good day, but it'll be in a town of like 300,000 people. It won't be in a big city like LA or something. In LA, actually, it's really hard to get people because everyone you know is already in a band, and nobody who's already in a band wants to go see another guy.
Another band.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because like, I mean, even I'm like that. I want to be playing. I don't want to be looking at everyone else playing. And I'll go if my friends are playing. But otherwise, it's like so much freaking work. And, you know, I've done the stage thing so many times that it just makes me feel tired just to think of going to a bar and standing over there for 2 hours and watching bands play. But
I think it's also the thing with being a musician. I think it's like the curse of being a musician, right? Like you just can't enjoy another band playing and like buying tickets for another band. So at these small towns that you would do in the US, was this at clubs? Was it at like festivals? Or was it just like, you know, shows that were put together by a promoter?
Mostly clubs.
I'm guessing there are a lot of metal clubs. Or these were just clubs that you let you play whatever music that you want to. I had a night that was just a metal night.
A combination. It depends. There are clubs that are like majority metal. There are a few like that in LA. But a lot of them are like completely different as well. And it's the same in India as well, right? Like you'll have country music one day, you'll have
the blues one day, and then you'll have,
exactly, stuff like that. And metal is usually on fucking Tuesdays. So
why is that?
I don't know. Maybe because metalheads are too broke and they don't buy enough booze. So you put metal on the worst days anyway.
That's probably like a very accurate guess. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That probably is a very accurate guess. All right. Let's have all the broke people wearing black shirts come on Tuesday, and at least someone exactly. will be there.
Right. But it is pretty awesome how the scene is pretty much the same anywhere you go. You know, like when I got the Frackline guys to India, Sandy and me are from Bangalore. The right. vocalist Jordan is from Kentucky in the States, and mm-hmm. The drummer Ray is from Mexico, mm-hmm. Cuernavaca. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting for them to see that, like, we played a gig in Bombay and we get into auto rickshaws with our instruments and stuff like that, and we pull up at that place and there's just a bunch of black t-shirts over there, and it's yeah. the same in the States. You know where the venue is by looking at the number of black t-shirts standing outside.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same. Yeah.
It's great. You can give like directions. It'd be like four people with long hair and like black shirts smoking outside. Yep. That's the place that you want to pull up to. This is pretty cool. Yeah, so I think so how long has it been since like Mindsnare has come to an end, right? Like how long has it been
Mindsnare came to an end pretty soon after we moved here, actually, because we managed to find other people to form projects with that matched exactly what we wanted to do a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And we played a few shows over here as Mindsnare, Sandy, Yas, and me.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have made sense for us to force it to go on, because I was having more fun with Frackline. Sandy and Yas and a couple other people put together this project called Serotura, which is super interesting. Check it out on YouTube if you have a moment. It's spelled Serotura. Those guys play some really crazy shit. I mean, that band isn't there anymore either, but they recorded some stuff and it's pretty cool. So yeah, that's kind of what we decided to do. We just like focused on exactly what we wanted to do, and because we were at a music school, it was possible to find people in that pool of students who matched what we wanted to do, had the maturity to do it, and the skill to actually play it.
Right. I think you brought up a very interesting point, because like metal, like you were saying, like unless you're like a Maiden or like a really top or like a top four metal mm-hmm. band, it's really difficult to sustain, right? And do you think sustain as in terms of financially and commercially as a band and even as individual musicians, right? To pay the bills and take care of stuff at home, families, whatever responsibilities that you have in life.
Right.
But at the same time, you want to play music that's exciting. And once, I think, is it like you get to a point once in your life where you'd be like, okay, this is not sustaining, but I still love music. So I've at least got to do the music that I seem fun. And many times in a band, like you want to go in a different direction and the other person wants to go in a different direction, but both of you as musicians, you want to play music that's true to you. And do you think because there's the financial aspect of it that's not holding bands down, do you think that's why a lot of bands go different directions after a few years or even in between?
Well, I guess that's like two very different questions. So the first one, like, yes, I think you with genres like extreme metal and technical metal, death metal and stuff like that, I don't think you get into playing that kind of music by thinking I'm going to make money out of this, because there is no precedent for that. I can't think of a single super rich technical death metal band. There isn't one. And because of that, I think a lot of people don't sell out, because you can't sell out. You can't do anything to magically make that style of music generate the kind of money needed in order to be fully sustaining. And I think I forget who exactly, but I think one of the periphery guys said that metal bands are basically advertisements for a t-shirt factory, you know? you just make the music so people will come and buy your shirts. That's where the profit is. That's the only way to really make money, by merch. Because
by merchandise,
Yeah, because your music is going to get pirated. It's going to go on Spotify. Spotify is going to pay you like 2 cents for every fucking 1,000 people who listen to it or some shit. Mm-hmm. There's no point. And you're going to be putting in a lot more money making the music than you'll be getting out of actually people listening to the music online or wherever. The only way to actually make money is by touring and by selling merch. And touring is basically getting out mobile advertisement with t-shirts on sale.
Hmm.
You know.
Right.
The second thing I think you asked was, do bands split up because of musical differences, because the financial thing isn't holding them together? I think I haven't really thought of it like that, but you could be right in a way, because in case, let's say Mindsnare was earning us like $100,000 each a year, it would have been a lot harder to disband that band if that were the case, because then we would have to think about, okay, so if we break this band up, then how do we pay rent? And then make decisions based on that. But that will end up with the music being diluted. The music is going to be based on how to earn money rather than based on what do I want to play and what do I want to write. So I don't know. I think it's great if you can make money playing the kind of music you want to play, but for us, it didn't work out that way, and we couldn't see a way to make it work out that way. So, you know, disbanding seemed better because we could get more creative satisfaction out of forming the other projects.
Beautiful. And I just want to ask you a question, not with respect to like Mindsnare or Fraklin or even like being a musician,
sure.
but globally, do you think like what has happened to metal? Do you think like it's gone a little more underground? Or it's been a little more subdued off late, right? Like, it was in the underground for a long time, right? So do you think, where is it right now? And are when we were young, like, I think when I was probably in the 8th standard or 9th standard when I tuned into metal. Of course, I didn't know Millennium, but almost every other band.
Yeah, right? I don't think Millennium might have been active at that point in time. So you shouldn't feel too bad for yourself.
But where do you think metal is like globally right now?
I think metal is a lot more prevalent and known globally right now than ever before, actually.
Think kids are still tuning into metal in high school?
Well, I don't know any kids in high school. It would be wrong if I did. But, you know, I've got a daughter who's going to be in high school in another 15 years or something.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lot more visible these days in movies, soundtracks, in video games, in various areas that some of those video games didn't exist when Millennium existed in the form that they are in right now.
Right.
So I think it depends on the style of metal as well. There are a lot of bands that personally, I don't think are real metal, but I may just be a bitter old man, like Five Finger Death Punch or something like that. I'm not going to call that metal, but you know. But
right.
A lot of those bands, I think, are a lot more popular. And those kinds of bands are also more popular in the US than I find them to be in India. In India, the metal heads are kind of more focused on like who's more metal than the other guy, like what's more underground and kind of or at least it was when I was more in tune with the scene over there. I'm not right now.
Yeah,
but
and I'm guessing it must really suck when you think of, dude, I know this really cool underground band which no one knows of, and then you find out that there's a plethora of other people who also know the same band. It's like, fuck everyone.
Well, I mean, that's one way to look at it, but I don't know. I never thought that a band is cooler because it's more underground. I always thought that that's kind of like a weird way to look at it. If it's good music, it's good music.
Mm-hmm.
And if more people hear about it, it's good. And like Iron Maiden, I love that fucking band. Everybody's heard of it. Mechanic Kids and like the Chick Pet where Iron Maiden t-shirts and rides on bikes. That So I don't think being well known is a detriment in any way, but some people do, and you know, it's their opinion, and that's how music works, right? You listen to different types of music in order to form your own identity as well. And if part of what you want is to like make yourself feel that you're unique and stand out from the crowd and stuff like that, then maybe that's one way to do it, by saying that you are only into underground metal bands, you know, who are so underground that they haven't even recorded a demo yet. Stuff like that.
Oh, so underground that we can cover them and everyone will think it's our original.
Right.
Right. So where are you right now in being a musician? Are you still playing music professionally? Are you still playing in a band?
No, I mean, there were a couple aborted starts at trying to write a solo album. I've got like four or five songs that I've written which are sitting around. I'm not quite sure what to do about it, but right now there are too many other things happening. Like there's this pandemic thing going around, which is a little inconvenient. And we just had a kid recently in March, so that takes way more time than anyone ever led me to believe. And given all that, right now there is not much writing up, anything happening. I'm not really looking at putting a band together in the near future, but might be some stuff you might hear about from the Mindsnare camp soon. Not new material, but some reworked old stuff that might happen soon.
All right. Okay, great. So I just want to end. I've taken so much of your time, dude. Like, I don't want to take too much of time because I know you have a kid and I don't want to take too much of your time. But like, I just want to ask you, I think probably a question or two before we come to the end of this. One is like, what have you, I think you've been like, I'm in the scene playing metal for at least more than 20 years, right?
No, I'd more say than, around maybe a little less than that. 16 years or something.
Probably 16 years. So what have been like your greatest learnings in all of this about like music and about like just yourself also, and like getting after what you liked and what you believed in?
Well, one of the main things that metal did for me was inform my ethics and morals by the lyrics of a lot of bands that I was into. Death is one of my favorite bands.
Yeah. And I'm so happy that you guys, Mindsnare, are there, because I found out Death through you guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. It was so weird. Like, there's actually an entire genre of metal named after the band, right? And it's such an underrated band, even till today. That it sucks. Yeah, but like, yeah, so thanks for that. Like, thanks for like introducing Death to
me. Of course. I don't know whether the genre is named after the band or whether the band is named after the genre, but, you know, who cares? It's amazing music.
It's great music and great lyrics,
so
too.
That guy's lyrics really inspire me. And a lot of Iron Maiden stuff as well when I was a kid that really made me introspect and contemplate about a lot of metaphysical things that I otherwise may not have jumped into that early. And I don't know, if the whole metal thing hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't have met the kind of people that I met, because it's a unique bunch of people that gets attracted to this kind of complicated, weird, aggressive music. And most of the time I find that they are deeply intelligent, introspective, nerdy, and they have a lot more going on in their lives than just, you know, like graduating from college, getting a job, getting married, and dying. So I credit the metal scene in general to like allow me to get in touch with a lot of these kinds of interesting people.
Right. All right. Great. I think that's a good way to end this podcast. But I just have the last question. And so what would be your advice to like musicians, metalheads across the world who are playing in obscure pubs where there are like some 30 people doing shitty college festivals, sometimes with horrible sound, most of the times with horrible sound, right? And who're still getting after it. So what would be your advice to them?
Well, what I found justified having to do that and made me feel good even when the audience was, you know, not even giving a damn about what we were playing and stuff was me feeling that the music that we were playing had some deeper meaning and purpose to it than just playing it and getting people to headbang to it. So on an absolute scale, if the music you write and perform has intrinsic value in it, in the music or the lyrics or why you do it, then I think you can't really be unhappy, because even if you're just playing it for yourself, you still have something intrinsic that you're contributing to the world. And it doesn't matter if the people in front of you don't see it. It's going to be the time that, you know, some guy on Facebook messages you like 5 years after you last picked up the guitar telling you that she was gonna commit suicide, and then he listened to your song and read your lyrics and decided that he didn't want to do that anymore because he wanted to think of other things. And you know, shit like that is what matters. It's not what's in front of you all the time. And if you play with an agenda, then you should not play metal, because it's not going to really get you rich or famous or laid most of the time, unless you're Van Halen. Van Halen got laid. Right.
Yeah, right. I think there's no better way that you could have put it, because like I really, it's so interesting, right? Because like, you know, like-minded people, like I don't know how, but it's just like-minded people just gravitate towards each other, right? And it happens not just in friends and in like at work or wherever you're hanging out with. It also happens with like with the stuff that you consume, right? Like it's so interesting that you said that the stuff, the way you got into a few bands is through the lyrics, and like not many people would bother saying like, okay, what apart from these really cool sounding riffs, what are they writing?
Right.
Not many people. But it's so interesting that when I dug you guys when I was in, I think 2009, 2010, about that time, right? The first thing I saw was your lyrics. And that's when I was a fan of you guys, right? It was like, and then your music came later. And it's so interesting that you were the same way, because like, and I think I can, I can quote your lyrics from like the last 10 years, right? Like, there are like stuff that there's so many great things that you have written. Like, I think, like if anyone has the time, you definitely should check out, even if you're not into metal, just read the lyrics. It's great work. And and it's so cool this happened. And I'm so happy that this podcast happened. And thank you, KP, for doing this.
Sure, man. Yeah, I think metal certainly sets a context for a lot of like-minded people to get together, and it's pretty awesome that this happened. Glad to be on here. Thank you, man.
All right, awesome. Is there anything that you want to plug before we come to this? Like, is there something that is in the works, or it's too early to talk about it? Did you want to plug?
There is something in the works. There is some Mindsnare stuff that you guys might be hearing about in the near future. Arun from Subcontinental Records is going to do something. So if you go to his Facebook page, just check out Subcontinental Records, and you'll be able to, if you like his page and get his notifications, you'll be informed when it's done.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you guys in the next episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Write Room Podcast. If you like my work, do follow me on Instagram, where I go by the handle of @PaulRupen. That's PaulRupen. Do subscribe to the podcast on whatever application you use. My podcast is out on a bunch of streaming applications like Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, and on Google Podcasts. And if you like the podcast, do give me a review. See you next week with a new guest and a new story.